I said, if memories always listen to you, it's funny because someone else would. That's my personality makes fun of you. Same as
Oh, you're referring that. That would been on her.
I don't know where Eric is. What happened to me? Find out.
Yeah,
good afternoon. I call the meeting of the Community and Public Safety Committee to order. It is Tuesday, July 15th at 2:31 p.m. Rebecca, will you please call the roll?
Mario.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Zimmerman. Smith.
Here.
Cannell.
Here. Christopher, will you please read the statement of conduct?
Welcome to the meeting of the Community and Public Safety Committee. To testify before this committee in person or virtually, you must sign up in advance on the committee agenda at www.portland.gov/council/agenda/community-and-public-safety-committee or by calling 311. Information on engaging with the committee can be found at this link. Registration for virtual testimony closes 1 hour prior to the meeting. In-person testifiers must sign up before the agenda item is heard. If public testimony will be taken on an item, individuals may testify for 3 minutes unless the chair states otherwise. Your microphone will be muted when your time is over. The chair preserves order. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or committee deliberations will not be allowed. If you cause a disruption, a warning will be given. Further disruption will result in ejection from the meeting. Anyone who fails to leave once ejected is subject to arrest for trespass. Additionally, the committee may take a short recess and reconvene virtually. Your testimony should address the matter being considered. When testifying, state your name for the record. If you're a lobbyist, identify the organization you represent, and virtual testifiers should unmute themselves when the clerk calls your name. Thank you.
Thank you. Today's meeting has two items on it. We're gonna hear a presentation from Portland Bureau of Emergency Management on their staffing and budget, and then we'll receive and consider the 2024 annual report for the Portland Police Bureau. Before I go into that first item, I did want to just note, although it is outside of the scope of any of the items today, I want to recognize that there's a lot of pain in our community right now around, in particular this week, due to the death of Damon Lamar Johnson. And I think as we are talking about this issue, we're going to be hearing a lot of different pieces of information over time. Things often move a lot slower than anyone would like. And, but what's important to remember is, you know, obviously first and foremost, our condolences to the family and those who knew Mr. Johnson. and also to recognize that there is a really deep pain right now, and in particular, I think for Black Portlanders, for people of color, as the only man of color on this council, I am very uniquely aware, and I hear that pain, and I feel it as well. And I want to acknowledge it before we get into any of the other items on today's agenda. Rebecca, will you please read the first item?
Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, FY 2025-26 Budget and Staffing.
Thank you. I believe we have Rachit Narwal here, and I'll pass it over to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Perfect. So we'll start with slide two. So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rachit Narwal, for the record, and I serve as the Chief Resilience Officer at the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. Today, I also have a few team members joining me online and in person who are available to address any specific questions that we might get today. Today, I'll be sharing how PPM plans to use the additional capacity, resources, and or funding that are awarded, that is awarded to us in this fiscal year's budget to strengthen cities' emergency preparedness and response capabilities. Before discussing these new resources, I'd like to start with a brief recap of what we have presented to the council over past few months to guide through how we are planning to improve on those items. So next slide, please. So since February of this year, PBM has conducted several assessments, some internally and some at the direction of the council members, and to identify the most significant gaps in our emergency, in cities' emergency management capabilities, and to determine whether additional where additional resources are most urgently needed. The slide in front of you shows the same assessment we have shared with the council several times since February. It highlights our core programs using a standard that I'll talk about in the next few seconds to indicate how well each area, each of our functional area or programs meet national emergency management standards. Program marked in red represent critical gaps where our capabilities are most limited. As you can see, there's a lot of red, but there's also programs that are slightly better, they're at risk, and then we have one program that's in yellow. So there are no programs that PBM runs right now that meet that standard. Now, you've also heard PBM talk about emergency management accreditation program standards in PASS. I'll briefly recap that as well before we dive into how we're planning to improve it. So next slide, please. So emergency management accreditation program is a nonprofit that certifies emergency management agencies meet nationally recognized standards. Now, I would like to note that PBM is not EMAP accredited. So the assessment that you saw for programs was internally done to present to the council. However, it is a goal of PBM to become EMAP accredited. To ensure consistency and accountability in our reporting to the council, we'll continue to use these standards as our benchmark and show how we can slowly but consistently improve on this. These standards provide a clear framework to guide improvement across all functional areas. Next slide, please. So you see how PBM programs were outlined in those several functional areas that I showed. So that's mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. Now, EMAP, Emergency Management Accreditation Program, calls out certain functional areas. So what you see in front of our 13 or 14 function areas that each have several components in it, that's where our program fits. So a single program, like for example, our neighborhood emergency team program, can fit into multiple of these functional areas. So it's just not assigned to one, it could be assigned to multiple function areas. And so does our staff. So a single staff can, even if, for example, I am working planning, I could also, with training and appropriate resources, I could also support incident management. So there is that kind of crosswalk that can happen between resources and current programs that we have. So previously on the slide that I showed that listed all the programs, what you see now are EMAP functional area categories. Each of these programs on the first slides now can fit into several of these buckets. In our internal assessment, most of these areas remain at a critical stage. So that's why you see a lot of red on here. And then there's some programs that are at risk. So we are doing relatively better on those programs, but we are still nowhere where we need to be. Moving forward, so next for rest of the presentation and also future presentation for the council, we'll use these functional categories and we can provide more detail about these functional categories if needed. We'll use this as a benchmark. New resources that are assigned to PBEM in this new fiscal year budget will help us make progress towards meeting EMAP standards in the areas that you see in front of you. In the next few slides, I'll share what functional areas we are hoping to improve on with these new resources. So next slide, please. So this year, this fiscal year, we are given three positions. Alert and warning was in the mayor's proposed budget, and then the council awarded us roughly $483,000, which we are planning to use for two positions. What you see in front of you are three positions that, or three programs that we'll be supporting with these positions. The two positions that the council has awarded us, the first position will be using as to support our operation plan. So this planner would focus on updating and maintaining emergency management preparedness and response plan for the city. Many of the plans that we currently have are out of date and require substantial revisions. While we are not, so substantial revision both because they're out of date, but also city structure has changed quite a bit in last year. So with the council structure changing and also how bureaus are align and how several programs within the bureaus have changed. So all these plans and operation guidelines need to be updated. So that's where we'll be focusing first with one of the positions that has been assigned to PBEM. Now, several times we have also been asked to support the CEI hub conversation that with, I believe, a different committee. While we are not funded directly in this particular allocation to support city's emergency management response for CEI hub, PBEM will continue to participate in the work that BPS is leading right now for the CEI hub. And I'd highlight that we'll continue to update our hazard plans that some of them have a risk associated with CEI hub. So for example, city's earthquake plan that has a CEI hub component to it. What we don't have right now is a dedicated plan for CEI hub, and we're not likely to get to it. This position will likely work on plans such as city's basic emergency operations plan and several operation guidelines that we currently use for our day-to-day emergency operations. Now, the second position we are planning to use for training and exercise. So this would be a position dedicated to this program. Right now, we have about 0.2 FTE dedicated to this whole program. So this is going to be a significant investment into our program. And thank you, Council, for helping us get this. So we'll be using this position to build internal capacity and improve readiness across all programs. To start, this position will focus on training. So think of it, right now we don't have very very many updated up-to-date plans, so we can't exercise those plans. So we'll start with the training program and improve on that. And that includes starting with the credentialing of city employees to support Emergency Management Operations Center in compliance with National Incident Management System and National Qualification System. These are all FEMA standards and nationally recognized standards. I can talk more about it if needed. So that's what we'll start with training and in terms of training. Eventually, our hope is that we can use this position to pivot to conducting more citywide exercises as well. And the training also includes training for city employees, including council members. Now, the third position, alert warning, which was in the mayor's proposed budget for us. Right now, we don't have a dedicated staff focusing on alert and warning. And the goal, once this position is filled, the goal will be for them to manage city's emergency management alert and warning operations. This includes management of city's alert and warning systems. Right now, that's Everbridge, and soon we'll have, we are onboarding a new system as well. And partnership with the state, including temp emergency management alerting templates, and also maintaining citywide communication protocols, citywide emergency communication protocols. Now, with these positions, PBEM definitely will be better positioned to close some of the critical gaps that I highlighted in the previous slide, and build a more resilient EM program. Now, I do want to highlight before I go to my next slide that the hiring process for these positions, right now we are looking at about at minimum 4 months. So it is not like we can quickly start. So as we'll hopefully do more of these presentations to inform the council on how we're doing. So please, I do want to recognize that this would be, this is a long-term improvement plan, not even for like this fiscal year. It will take us time to build and develop our capabilities in these areas that have been awarded to us. So it's 4 months at minimum, but could very well be between 4 to 6 months before a candidate is able to start at the job. Next slide, please. So this is a slide I wanted to highlight. I think the bottom part got cut, but so this is what we are hoping to achieve with the new positions that have been awarded to us. So what you see is a side-by-side comparison of where we are right now and where we plan to be with these new positions by June 2027. So the slide shows how we intend to strengthen our capacity. The blue highlight that you see in the EMAP, in the first column, EMAP functional areas, is where we are dedicating these new resources: operational planning, communication and warning through alert and warning position, and training and exercise. As I said in my previous slides, that like, for example, if you improve on operational plan, so let's say you update a plan and you improve it, there's definitely some benefit that trickles down to other functional areas as well. So you will improve on program administration as well if you improve one area. So there's definitely that correlation that I've reflected in this assessment. And again, this is a goal of ours. Realistically, so we'll continue to update the council on how we're progressing on these items. So on the rightmost column, you see where we intend to be by June 2027. So you will see direct improvement in the areas that will be that the resources will be assigned. So operational planning, hopefully, will move from critical. So right now, no one doing that job. So we'll slowly work on improving and getting those plans up to date and having people train on these plans and exercise. So we're hoping to move to, we'll still not meet the standard with one planner, but we'll definitely hoping to see some improvement in that program area. Same goes for communication and warning. You see it's still at risk with a dedicated position. I do want to highlight that. So there are several factors there are several indicators that you have to factor in. That's when the program kind of moves from one category to another. We still will not have a 24/7 capacity to issue an alert. It's a position that will help us maintain the program better. So we still lack in terms of that 24/7 alerting capability, and recent Texas flood and the California incident are still, you know, make us very, very concerned about that capacity, about that capability. But yeah. And so same goes for training and exercise. We'll hopefully, with the position that we have, that we'll get, and when will they start? We'll start building training and exercise program for the city and hoping to improve on those key areas as well. So that's the end of my slide. I can give in more details about what these positions will be doing as needed, but I'm happy to take any questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Narwal. So at this point, we do have some time for Q&A. So I'll ask colleagues to get into the queue if they have any questions that they'd like to ask of PBEM. I have a couple myself, but I'll just see if anyone else gets into the queue first. Okay. Could you go back to slide 7 on the screen, please? This is that comparison. First off, thank you for doing this. I think this is a helpful framing device for us as we look at what the impacts that are expected for a decision are. And I would encourage maybe not this exact assessment method, but this two-column comparison is a very clear way to look at that. I also appreciate your insight as to why program administration would be supported by that. Is the intention, so I have two questions on this slide. One is, as it relates to the planners, you explained why operational planning would improve. Continuity planning is just not expected to be part of that next person's job. Is that why that isn't improving?
Yeah, so right now we have no resource that are doing the continuity planning. And it is a program in itself. There will be enough work for this one planner to focus on before we get to continuity of operations. So that's why I have, with the current resources that we have, we're not likely to see significant improvement there, because I know, like, if you have to if I have to write a work plan for this new position, continuity is not going to be a priority. We have three plans at least that I can list that are high priority that needs to be updated ASAP.
Thanks. The other question I had was around incident management. So I just want to point out, you know, PBEM put together for council a what would you need to be simply reverse the years of cuts that you've taken, not even to get fully to where you all think you need to be. And that was, I believe, 12 or 13 positions. And it was a very helpful framework, and we were only able to get three in this year's budget. So I'm very happy we were able to do that, but I just want to contextualize this as if people are wondering why there's not more yellow, let alone green, on here, it is they got a quarter of what they asked for that base level. So incident management, can you talk through what that would need to get to the level of maybe not a bare minimum, but functionality? So I guess in this case, we're talking about yellow.
Yeah, I'd like to invite Chris Carey, our ops.
I saw him back there.
To chime in more on this before I start.
And please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure, good afternoon. Hi, I'm Chris Carey. I'm the Preparedness and Response Manager for the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. As far as getting our kind of our incident and sort of specifically to your question, the incident management team, the incident management framework, how we're getting that up and what it would take us to get from red to yellow. So as I'm not specifically familiar with the EMAP standards, but I can tell you the path that we are on is getting to the point where we can have a single citywide emergency operations plan, which I think we've been getting in some great practice and some great reps, and we are certainly moving in that direction, especially with our police, fire, BOIC, public works partners, as well as the rest of the city team. Secondly, it's not just kind of doing that in that ad hoc fashion. It's also kind of assembling the team beforehand, training and exercising that team so we can show up, drop of a hat, ready to go. So we're building the administrative system. We're building the personnel to use that administrative system. And then we're also building just the administrative framework to support that system. Because let's say we get a true joint team together from the entire city. You could have someone from, you know, Portland Fire Bureau running operations, someone from Portland, you know, Bureau of Transportation running logistics. You know, we could be running finance and administration, and they're just within the different roles. Those are all different funding streams. Those are all different processes. Those are all different, you know, agreements that we need to work out and refine.
Yeah, and also I'll just add to that to kind of simply address it. The functional areas that you see, we need to improve on a lot of these functional areas to get incident management to a point where we can comfortably say it's at least yellow,
yeah.
At least 4 to 5 positions. So having contingency planner dedicated as a dedicated position, having training, so we used to have a training coordinator and an exercise coordinator. So having those two positions separated out. So there's 3 to 4 or 4 to 5 positions in the ops additional will help us get there.
And would green require probably having that 24/7 capability as well?
Yes, that definitely. Well, so again, the ASPR EMAP standards, there are certain things they did. So I don't want to say something that's inaccurate. That does the EMAP standard require us to
sure.
have a 24 capability to make it green? But to have for size a city the size of Portland, that is an ultimate goal of ours. So the internal exercise that I talked about previously had an end goal of close to 54 positions.
And for context, how many do you have now?
Right now we have 11 or 12, I could be wrong, and we got these three positions more. So yeah, so we are still, that's why, and thank you for pointing out, they're still not, we're far from green right now.
Yeah, I do wanna just commend, cause I believe it's in your team, Mr. Carey, the NET program is the one yellow on, I think it's slide 4.
I wish I could take credit for that, but Mr. Nawal.
Well, and for those watching at home, you should consider becoming a neighborhood emergency team volunteer. I'd be remiss if I didn't flag that. But yeah, I did want to commend that. I think I'll pause here just to see, and I see Councillor Novick has a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about some of the things that we need and don't have. But one, the 24/7 watch capacity and coordination response capacity, where we had asked for additional resources and weren't able to get them. But if you could just remind us of what those two things mean and why it's important.
Yeah, so 24, so the reason, again, the communication warning role in here is not improving, even with the dedicated position to alert and warning is not going yellow or green, is we don't have capacity to do a kind of no notice alert, but someone's not waking up and making that assessment. It's still someone needs to be woken up. Someone's not monitoring 24/7 within EM department. I'm not speaking about other bureaus. So that's what the intention with those 54 position is, to have a system like Watch Command that other cities, some of the other cities have, that I believe our assessment is like, I could be wrong, up to 6 positions. So that will help us run where someone is actively monitoring all scale of incidents, so small to big or in magnitude. So they're monitoring 24/7, and that's enough consistent staffing that people, there will be someone on call all the time. So that's how many positions that we have identified. That will help us get there. And that's a key component to improving communication and warning piece of things. And if anything, this Texas incident has highlighted, I mean, there were other things going on with Texas. I don't want to say this was the only thing, but definitely has highlighted the need for that.
And there was also, you talked about the need for coordination and response personnel to coordinate functions, communications, and operations for people both internal and external involved in the response. I think you still don't have people dedicated to that.
Roger, sir, and that's one of the things that kind of, as I believe you were saying a little bit earlier, kind of each one of our team members has at a minimum that second hat. So normally if there's like a 24-hour operation right now, Richit and I are working opposite sides of the clock. And that would just kind of help facilitate relieve stress on staff with high operational tempo, and also make the city more efficient and make the team teams work a little bit better together.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just ask one more time if anyone has any questions. I imagine Councillor Zimmerman can't be here. I'm going to guess we'll have some things he might want to follow up with you on as well. I know this is an interest area of his. So I think we're looking at the ask here. What's really interesting is the remaining ask that was unmet in the budget is in the ballpark of, I think, under $2.5 million, which is a literally small price to pay. We're not a lot of what we're talking about here is 24/7 and capacity, not just for PBIM, but we have these conversations with 311. We have these conversations with Portland Street Response, and a lot of it is, this is not a city that never sleeps. It's a city that I think if we had 24/7 capacity and all these things, would be able to sleep better. And so I'm hoping that that's a conversation we're able to bring up. I also just wanted to shout out not only PBIM's work, but everyone's work at bringing the system closer together so that we can stop being 27 bureaus in a trench coat as a city and get closer to being first 4 service areas in a trench coat and eventually one unified city on things like the citywide emergency management plan that you mentioned. So we'll wrap it up here. Thank you so much. I can't imagine this will be the only time we talk about PBIM staffing in the near future, but I appreciate your time and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebecca, while folks are switching at the dais, will you please call the second item?
Item 2, accept the 2024 Portland Police Bureau Annual Report.
Thank you, colleagues. We are in the process of hearing the PPB's annual report for 2024. We will, unlike the previous item, which was a discussion, there is the need to take an action today, which would include the possibility of referring the item to the full City Council for its consideration and approval. We have several speakers here. I will pass it to Assistant Chief McMillan first. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm going to have everyone here, all of my colleagues here, they're joining us, introduce themselves.
I'm Rob Simon. I'm the commander of North Precinct.
Amanda McMillan. I'm an assistant chief.
Council, my name is Brian Hughes. I'm the commander of Central Precinct.
Good afternoon. My name is Derek Foxworth, captain of East Precinct.
Great. As you said, I'm here today to present the Portland Police Bureau's 2024 annual report. Last month, Chief Day presented some of this information at our public meetings. We received substantial support from residents who want to engage with police and help address public safety issues. We recognize that 2024 seems like a lifetime ago at this point, and we wish we could have been here months ago, but this process does take considerable time. We were actually able to move it up by several weeks this year, if it's any consolation. The process includes, to get it to this point, gathering the data from 2024 that can take into the first quarter, obviously, to retrieve all that and have all the reports submitted. Then our team writes and designs it with the chief's input, then ultimately review it internally before submitting it to PSEP. And then PSEP has several weeks to review it before their meeting where they give feedback. We take that feedback, incorporate that into the final report. Then we have our public sessions at each of the precincts to present the information. And so this is our next to the final step before, as we're required to do, to present it to the full city council. Before I really launch on all this, I wanted to say, just how proud I am of both our sworn and our professional staff at the Bureau, the resiliency and commitment they continue to show day to day. I just want to say thank you for the amazing work that they do, the professionalism they show, compassion they demonstrate every day. I really am proud to serve with the people that I serve with at the Police Bureau. Next slide. When Chief Day began his tenure, he really focused the organization around three goals: transforming the dynamic between the police and the people we serve, reducing crime and the fear of crime, and then focusing on organizational growth and development. These goals remain with us today, and they're really woven into everything that we do and everything we focus on. This presentation will first focus on these three goals. Next slide. One of the biggest changes in 2024 was the implementation of body-worn cameras. By the fall, all of our sworn members were trained and had them. This was a years-long effort that got stalled due to many factors. PBB has been wanting these cameras for a long time, and we truly believe it will enhance the community-police relationship. It means all stakeholders, police and community, will have greater accountability, and we'll have more transparency when it comes to critical events. In the area of community engagement, our behavioral health unit continues to be a tremendous resource for the city and for the Bureau. They facilitated 43 trainings and outreach events last year. These events have included community members, businesses, and outside agencies. Public safety support specialists, our PS3s as we call them, also participated in more than 40 hours of community engagement. Additionally, our PPB cadets who volunteered their services participated in more than 81 community events. Our Office of Community Engagement once again connected our advisory groups with the biased crimes detectives. This has been proven to be a successful model that improves crime prevention and the fear of crime, while also sharing public awareness about these crimes. Biased crimes and biased events can be difficult to understand. These complexities were shared with our culturally specific advisory groups, such as the Muslim, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander American Councils. And finally, walking beats were implemented again during the holiday season. This is a priority for us. We wanted foot patrols to create a visible presence in the downtown core during the holiday season and during the NCAA volleyball tournament that brought thousands of visitors to the city. A visible presence can go a long way to reducing the fear of crime. Next slide. Last year, the city of Portland saw some successes in the area of crime reduction. Reported person crimes decreased by 4%. Any loss of life is too much. Homicides, however, did trend down 8% last year. As you know, gun violence really soared in recent years, but last year's shooting incidents fell by 22% for the second year in a row. There's still twice as many shootings as we had in 2019, however. PPB seized more than 1,400 firearms. It's a 17% increase. And we actually seized more illegal guns than Seattle and Oakland, which is a great accomplishment. We continue to work collaboratively under the ceasefire model with our partners in violence prevention. I also periodically, through this report, because we are halfway through the year, want to highlight 2025 statistics just for reference, and hopefully just for a little bit of education on where we are so far. To date, there's been 19 homicides in the city this year. Last year at this time, we had 43. Gun violence remains down. We've had 324 shootings so far this year, just down 31% from last year. Next slide. So now we'll chat a little bit about property crimes. We know these can have a huge impact and do have a huge impact on our community. We saw a decrease of 12% in 2024 in property crimes. We also saw a 34% reduction in stolen vehicles. We really continue to make great strides in this area as a result of our data-driven missions. We still see a rise this year in shoplifting reports, but we believe this is due to our efforts and continual work with retailers, encouraging reporting so that we can really highlight where it's happening so that we can bring resources to bear in those appropriate areas. Next slide. We continue to focus on mission work and believe that is what is driving down many of our crime categories. Earlier this year, we provided Council with the Bureau's crime reduction plan that included information on these missions, including the related data and the costs of those missions. Some of that material was woven into the annual report because it was and continues to be our focus. East Precinct's data-driven missions were what kicked off our evidence-based policing model. We continue the stolen vehicle operations missions, and all the precincts conducted crime suppression or retail theft missions in 2024 as well. This year, we have continued these missions. East Precinct so far has conducted 6 stolen vehicle missions and recovered 31 stolen vehicles. Also of note, we continue to work collaboratively with surrounding agencies and have involved 6 area law enforcement agencies to help us in this work. Portland has seen one of the largest decreases in stolen vehicles in the nation, and in February recorded a 10-year low. We also conducted missions around illegal street racing and street takeovers. Some of these are resource intensive, including a multi-agency one last August that was focused on deterring a large event planned in Portland. And as stated, retail theft missions continue in all of our precincts. We routinely seize illegal firearms, locate stolen vehicles, and find people with warrants involved in all of these crimes. In 2024, we conducted 14 human trafficking missions. This crime greatly impacts neighborhood livability while also being connected to illegal guns and drugs. We hear pleas and concern from the community, particularly in the 82nd Avenue corridor, around this issue. Their schools, businesses, homes, families, all deeply impacted by this crime. All of these missions have made a major impact on our crime reduction. Next slide. In 2024, there were 274 overdoses reported to PPB. We're pleased to see this trend downward, but we know there's still a lot of work to be done here. Our central bike squad has been engaged in regular missions downtown to address crime and livability issues, including drug dealing, unlawful weapons possession, stolen vehicles, graffiti, and other vandalism. We offer deflection services to those that meet the criteria as well. And in 2024, we also strengthened our narcotics and organized crime unit, adding personnel to work on these multi-level investigations that focus on large-scale drug busts. So far this year, we have seen 123 overdoses reported. Last year at this time, there was 177. New slide. 66 people died in traffic crashes in 2024. We're working closely with our partners at the Portland Bureau of Transportation and focusing on high crash areas. And while this is down from 75 traffic fatalities in 2023, this remains a very concerning issue. Our traffic division continues to use grant funds for special regional missions that focus on things such as speeding and driving while impaired. To date, in 2025, 16 people have died in traffic crashes this year. Next slide. Our staffing shortage remains a top priority and we're still challenged by it. We hired 74 sworn members and 35 professional staff in 24. This included 11 public safety support specialists. Our hiring remains consistent. We're doing well as compared to some of our regional partners who say they are having more difficulty attracting candidates. We received 1,537 applications for police officer and conducted 577 officer background investigations in 24. However, we did process 78 sworn and 39 professional staff separations, so we're essentially breaking even there. The last few years, we've seen large numbers of our sworn personnel retire. In 2025, we aren't facing any of those retirement cliffs, and we're looking to this as a year of growth. In addition, we have almost 90 officers in training, and many of them will be finished with probation this year. That will help bolster our patrol ranks for sure. We still have about 87 vacancies that we are working toward filling. Our recruitment efforts continue to be robust. So far in 2025, those efforts are really starting to gain traction. This year, we're averaging 151 applicants a month, which is about 40 more each month than last year. We currently have 387 candidates in the pre-background phases. Our recruitment team will be at approximately 38 more events planned this year. That includes in the Portland, specifically Greater Oregon and the neighboring states as well. Our recruitment social media platforms and Join PPB website are some of the prime law enforcement recruitment accounts in the country pertaining to activity and new material. Next slide. So just a few words here about our facilities. We face maintenance related to aging in all of our precincts, and our team spent a lot of time last year working on reconstruction efforts on the Justice Center, specifically following the ice storm of January 2024, so that took a lot of resources. We also continue to try to find the most effective workspaces for our specialty units. In regard to fleet, we need to replace about 100 of our non-patrol vehicles that are past the replacement period. We're also launching an electric patrol vehicle program, pilot program. But first, we have to build the infrastructure to make that work. Each precinct is being outfitted with that infrastructure so we can move forward with the use of electric vehicles. The good news, this past year, we were able to replace a very aging mobile precinct. These vehicles are typically used at crime scenes, major scenes, critical events, homicides, community engagement events, or if there's areas that have increased crime. New slide. The Bureau's training is always a top priority. Training is a critical part of our continued growth and improvement. We have revamped our training since hiring a civilian dean of training, and we rely on this division to do a tremendous amount of work. Training has a number of academies occurring at any given period, including ones for our new hires, advanced academies, cadets, public safety support specialists, specialized training, and more. Next slide. Now we'll talk about use of force and deadly force. All uses of force are tracked, and we work to ensure uses of force are appropriate through review and training. We hold officers accountable when they act outside of policy. We emphasize our overarching principle regarding the use of appropriate and constitutional force in training, as well as in our force policy, which you can read here on the screen. Next slide. There were 6 uses of deadly force in 2024. 3 were fatal and 3 were non-fatal. There was also 1 in custody death. We understand that applications of deadly force impact our community, and I want to assure you that these cases were thoroughly investigated by PPB and the District Attorney's Office. In all uses of deadly force, we follow a stringent process, which is reflected in Directive 10-10-10. With the advent of body cameras, we have re-emphasized our commitment to transparency by releasing video within 14 days of those incidents. That occurred for the last 3 officer-involved shootings and in-custody death. We also have summaries of these incidents and every deadly force incident since 2010 on our website, and we encourage everyone to look at them on our open data portal. Next slide. As I said, uses of force, all uses of force are tracked. In 2024, community members or visitors initiated just over 209,000 calls for service. These calls resulted in a use of force 0.17% of the time. Of these calls, 238 resulted in a use of category 2 or 3 force, 0.11%, and 128 of those resulted in a use of category 4 force at the 0.06%. Compared to last year, there's a reduction in category 4 force, which is the lowest level of reported force. Recently, the Bureau did implement a change in this policy to recategorize control against resistance and resisted handcuffing. New slide. In 2024, officers initiated 61,334 calls for service. Of these calls, 176 resulted in a use of category 2 or 3 force. That's 0.29% of those calls. And 39 resulted in a use of category 4 force, 0.06%. Next slide. Of the, just another way to sort of break it down, of the 13,297 custodies in 2024, 5.9% resulted in a use of force. Category 2 to 3 force was 4.55 of those, and category 4 accounted for 1.33% of those. Once again, everything on the website, including our quarterly force reports for review. Next slide. Stops data. This is also all on the website. Portland Police Bureau has been collecting data on traffic and pedestrian stops since 2001. In 2024, PPB performed 24,182 driver stops, a 41% increase over the previous year. Most of the increase can be attributed to Traffic Division being active the entire year after being previously disbanded. However, most of the other divisions also saw increases as well. Next slide. 40% of driver stops occurred in East, 33% in Central, and 26% in North precincts. No perceived race or ethnic group of drivers that were overrepresented were overrepresented compared to the injury collision benchmark. Similarly, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission in 2024 stops report found no differences in the rate of stopped drivers by the Bureau using the veil of darkness methodology. Next slide. In 2024, 98% of drivers were stopped solely for traffic offenses. Speeding was primarily the primary offense observed by traffic officers, 44.2% of the time, with missing or expired license violations as the predominant stop for non-traffic personnel, 39.8%. Next slide. In 2024, approximately one out of every 158 stops included a discretionary search, and the majority, 60.8% of those, resulted in contraband being located. Next slide. In our precinct meetings, we continually remind folks that stops and searches are governed by the U.S. and state constitutions as well as Oregon law. We really want to continue to discuss with community members their rights and responsibilities, and when stopped, community members have a responsibility to comply with an officer's direction. Next slide. In 2022, PPB implemented new practices to ensure compliance with legislative changes that were coming. Officers created a record of their request to search and provide a written explanation of the right to refuse. PPB policy goes beyond the minimum of the new state law requirements. The 2024 search rate, 0.6%, is the lowest on record for the PPB. Only 0.4% of drivers, 90 in total, were asked to consent to a voluntary search. No disparate search patterns based on perceived race or ethnicity of the driver have been identified. Next slide. We actually require officers to provide a card that explains in 5 languages a person's right to refuse to a consent search. You know, the card explains to people that they have the right to say no when asked for consent to search and to withdraw their consent at any time during the search. These steps do not affect existing authority, of course, to conduct a search without consent. If the officer has legal basis to search a car or a person, they may still do so, even if the person refuses in those instances. Next slide. The Bureau remains committed to bias-free policing. Our directives require officers to engage in bias-free policing. These requirements go beyond what is explicitly required in state law. All 4 members have been trained on implicit bias as well. Okay, I know I ran through that really fast. We'll take any questions. And one last closing thing, as you all know, we're required per the DOJ agreement with the city. We have to present this in front of full council, and we're scheduled to do that on August 6th. So we also will have an opportunity to answer questions then too, if they come up, so.
Thank you, Chief McMillan. We're gonna open this up for questions. Please feel free to get in the queue. I'll try to do a couple rounds of this. We actually do have, this is the only other item on our agenda today. So I might ask you to pause and let your colleagues get in to the queue, and then we'll circle back around. So we'll start with Councilor Murillo and then go to Councilor Smith after.
Hi everyone, thanks so much for your presentation today. I was wondering if we could go back to the slide where we talked about the traffic stops. And some of the data around that. I was curious about the methodology. It says, I think we were on that one. There we go.
Stops data.
I was kind of surprised to see this. It says that there's no perceived race or ethnic group of drivers that were overrepresented when compared to the injury collision benchmark. So I was wondering if you could outline that a bit more and explain what the veil of darkness methodology is to come to that conclusion. That's my first question.
Yes, I can give you a very high-level layman's understanding of the injury collision benchmark, which is the rate at which collisions happen based on race or perceived ethnicity. We're comparing, that's the benchmark by which we're comparing, is how our division.
Oh, okay. So the benchmark. So it's about collisions, not about the stops being broken down by.
So they compare, so they use the collision rate as a benchmark. So as the standard against which they're comparing. Does that make sense?
No.
No.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
So they're in the stops data collection report, and I think we can try to pull one up just to show the table. It has a table where one column is the percentage, each row is a racial category. One column is the percentage of stops that were of drivers of that racial category. The other column is the benchmark by which you compare that to. and the percentage used there is the is what's called the injury collision benchmark. And I'm not sure about this last part, but is it the percentage of total people involved in a injury collision within the city who are of that racial category? It's, I'm going to pull this up. I had the, we, you put out a report every quarter, so.
Yes, I don't have it in front of me. So I would defer to the report and, or we would, you know, come back to speak to it with one of our strategic services folks that could break down the benchmarking and statistical analysis, which is well beyond what I would be able to relate here.
Okay, while Councillor Canall pulls that up, and maybe that will be more enlightening if I see it in a table, can you explain why we're not just breaking down the stops data based on population and then percentage based on race like we used to? I feel like we used to have a much more simple breakdown of like, okay, you had 52% of stops were Black Portlanders. Our population in Portland of Black people is like around 6%. So obviously we saw that there was some disparity in that breakdown. Do we have any updated information on that? Because I don't think I saw that in this presentation.
My understanding is it's a number of years, and I don't want to misquote on how many years, but it's been quite a few years that we've used this benchmark. Now, the other numbers are out in the world or get spoken to because everyone can look at
that was a long
breakdowns
yeah.
And whatnot because it's just out in the public sphere. But this is the, and again, our strategic services folks would be able to bring the science behind their statistical analysis.
Yeah, I feel like for a presentation, I would like to have that broken down. I think the methodology is important. I don't really understand the collision benchmark and why that's being used as a metric when I think in the past we had very simple presentations that explained this number of people of this race were pulled over in a city that is majority white. So I have some questions about why we are now having a much more, and maybe I'm just not a statistical genius, but I feel like it shouldn't take a statistical genius to understand the race breakdown of our police stops. So if someone could break that down for me later, or if you could bring that person in since we have some time, that'd be awesome. But Councillor Canall, I don't know if you've pulled up that chart yet.
Still looking, so I'll...
Okay, I will pass it off to the next person to ask some questions while you take a look.
Great. Councillor Smith, you're next in the queue, followed by Nope.
Thank you, Co-Chair Canall. Thank you all for your presentation. That was great. I had a couple of clarifying questions. You say there are 100 new officers in the queue, and there's 87 vacancies. So is that 100 a part of that 87, or that 87 is after we bring in the new 100?
87 after we bring okay. in. The folks that are already hired are being counted, and so the vacancies persist after that.
And I know you all are not data researchers and that kind of thing, but when I look at 274 overdose deaths in the city of Portland, that's kind of high to me. And I don't know what is contributing to that. I don't know if, I mean, we have talked about getting, you know, the drugs off the street in downtown area, but I would like to see if there is a way to desegregate the data to show where those deaths are coming from. If it's coming from East Portland, if it's coming from West Portland, that would be great. To really know, and it's kind of along the same lines that the counselor is asking for Murillo. And I just want to get a sense, because if that is in downtown Portland, we could probably estimate, you know, what that's from. But I don't know if the overdose death, if they also cross with the homeless deaths as well. Are they categorized twice? Because some homeless folks, they have drug addictions and they use drugs. And so is their death based on them not being housed, or is it because of their drug use and or abuse?
We can definitely dig more, present more on overdose deaths, more in depth on overdose deaths.
If you could do that and see how they cross with folks who are homeless, see how if what percentage of those 274 were they homeless or not? Because then that makes a difference when we're talking with the county and the joint office about how we spend our resources. We have put an incredible amount of money into the homeless continuum. And so I want to make sure if there are ways in which we can save lives in the city, that we figure out how to do that and how to attack this number. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Councillor Smith. We'll go to Councillor Novick next.
I have a series of disconnected questions, so I'm counting on the chair to shut me up when he thinks I've asked too many. We can move on. One is to follow up on Councillor Smith's comment just now. How many of the homicides are the victims houseless?
I didn't have it.
I don't have it off the top of my head, but I can certainly get it for you.
Okay. Because that obviously is of interest. I mean, people who are houseless are in various ways more at risk. So to find out how that affects the homicide figures would be interesting. On the traffic stops, how much of a correlation is, well, here's the general question and then more specific ones. How much of a correlation is there between the kind of things people are stopped for and the kind of things people die from? Like if we, are we stopping people for speeding? Are we stopping people for running red lights? I know we're stopping people for DUI. To the extent we're stopping people for like expired plates, et cetera, that's not to say that that's not important, but it's not life-threatening. So one thing I'm like curious about is what balance should we strike in terms of doing traffic enforcement between like speed cameras and red light cameras versus more cops on the beat? So could you sort of elaborate on what kind of things people are stopped for and what impact you think that has on fatalities and injuries?
I think, I think the numbers bear out that the vast majority of stops conducted by like our traffic division, for example, who are, you know, very dedicated and focused on reducing traffic fatalities on the streets in Portland. And they're out there targeting serious moving violations like speeding and certainly red lights and things like that as they see those, but speeding in particular and then impaired driving. So those are things that are, don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm comfortable putting it out there, largely very significantly related to a lot of the traffic fatalities that we see, right? We're going to see impaired drivers and we're going to see speed contributing both or one or the other mm-hmm. in the vast majority of crashes. So, yeah.
If there's any way that that's kept track of, that would be great to see. Like what percentage of stops involve speeding? What percentage of stops involve running red lights, seeing impairment, et cetera?
I thought they were broken down in there. I might be wrong. I'll have these guys correct me by moving and non-moving. And that would be probably the line that you're looking,
right.
you're looking for. You know, is somebody staying in their lane,
gotcha.
Running a red light, speeding? That's going to be in our moving violation. That's how we would refer to those versus non-moving violations, which is you have no headlights or brake lights or you have expired license or registration, things like that.
Another big broad question is, we hear periodically from constituents about there's a certain kind of crime that happens in this location every damn day, like at bottle return facilities. People, you know, come in and return their bottles, and sometimes they're like, you know, they only open up some parts of the week, and then people get their money, and the drug dealers are right there and accepting the money. So the people, like in the Central East Side, are asking, can't you just have the police there, you know, several nights in a row to put an end to this open air drug dealing? Now, my guess is the response to that, there's probably like thousands of places in the city like that. You just don't have the resources to cover all of them. But I'd like to hear an answer just so I can like give an answer the next time I hear a complaint like that.
Yeah, I can speak a little bit to that. That's a fairly significant issue that we have in East Portland. It's something I hear fairly regularly from community members. And so it's striking the balance of making sure there are people that are legitimately using the bottle drop for a variety of reasons. So making sure that our strategies that we implement aren't disproportionately impacting those folks. And so we do a fair amount of focus patrol work in and around those areas to target the drug dealers, and then also to hopefully try and connect folks that unfortunately may be suffering from drug addiction to get them connected with resources. We do that with limited resources when we have additional time and ability to do that, but it is something that we're doing on a regular basis.
Thank you. I said I was going to jump around a bit. I hear people complain about the plane. A guy I know says, the plane flies around all the time. God knows what it's doing. It's always in North Portland. It's annoying the hell out of us. Why do you have the plane, and why is it annoying us?
North, Rob, you want to feel that? He said North specifically.
Yep. So. Well, our air support unit is used for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's surveillance. Sometimes it's activities related to street racing missions. So, for example, on Sunday night, we had it up flying over a street racing event that was happening on Sunday night in North Portland. So that's one reason why we have it. They're also involved in a lot of the follow-up investigations for other divisions, whether it be homicide or major crimes, or those following around suspects and witnesses and trying to corroborate where people are. We also use it during our criminal interdiction missions, our stolen vehicle operation missions, as a deterrent to traffic pursuits. They're a way that we use it to alleviate the police bureau from having to engage in vehicle pursuits, which are inherently dangerous for the city. We use the plane as our de-escalation tool, so the driver is making their own decisions how they drive without police ever being present.
Okay, elaborate on the last one. Does that mean that you're not, you're just sort of being there so people are aware of it, or is it involved in, or is the plane always involved in a particular mission?
We ask the plane is involved in several of our missions, specifically for stolen vehicle operations missions. We want the plane involved. So when the officer initiates a traffic stop and the subject in the suspect vehicle flees in the stopped right. vehicle, we don't want to engage in a traffic pursuit as best we can on city streets, depending on time of day, obviously. But we use the plane as a deterrent tool to be flying overhead to track that stolen vehicle when it either goes to ground, it crashes, it parks, the guy gets out and runs, and then we can try to get in there.
Okay, so when you talked about it's to track a specific vehicle, it's not just sort of flying around as a general deterrent.
Oh, no, no.
All right. Yeah. So it sounds like what I might be able to tell by, he's not a constituent, this guy I know, is that the plane is not sort of randomly flying around doing patrols. It's always up there for a specific mission-driven reason.
Yeah, it's it's mission-driven tool, yes.
I pause you there?
Yeah.
Thanks. Not because of length, but because I think it's a good pause point. And I have a question on this issue too. On April 5th, there was a large protest downtown. It was the hands-off protests. Either that night or the next day, I had a sit-along at BOEC, 911 center. There was a report of, there were two reports that night of drivers evading. There's just good use of the plane, right? You would use the plane, as far as I understand it, this is how it was explained to me by the telecommunicators, to ensure that police officers are not involved in the pursuit, but at some point that car is going to stop somewhere. And then police officers can go to the scene where they are and apprehend without a high-speed pursuit, right?
Yes.
I was told that in this particular case, the plane was unavailable because it has exceeded its maximum flight hours or potentially needed refueling because it had been surveilling the protest downtown. Without commenting on, because I don't want to put you on the spot about that specific day 3 months later, and I would like to understand, is that one of the uses, I have two questions on this, is that one of the uses that the plane is regularly assigned to?
To the protest environment?
Correct.
Well, I'm not a crowd management incident commander. I'm a critical incident commander, so I manage more of the CERT team and SWAT team side of things.
Sure.
That question would be much better suited for a crowd management incident commander who's in charge of the incident. I know in the past they have requested him for specific reasons. I don't know the answer to the question, though, Commissioner or Counselor, sorry. Whether or not they're doing it on a regular basis, I don't believe that they are. But again, that would have to be something I'd have to follow up with.
Okay. When officers are working on that particular assignment for the plane, are they working overtime usually? Is that one of the responsibilities that might that would usually or always be overtime?
You can speak to that. We have two sergeants assigned to air support. And so those are our only full-time personnel assigned to that. Most of the work, the extra stuff that gets done, the missions and things around the police bureau are on overtime because we don't have enough humans to address the work within a 40-hour work week, and or it's come up short term, you know, short. So yes, our pilots and our flight observers will be operating unless they've adjusted a shift. I couldn't speak to a specific day necessarily. I'd have to research that, but generally speaking, it's overtime to accomplish those missions because they have a regular, you know, they have a day job, basically. This is an extra job that they've agreed to take on in the police bureau to get trained on and participate in. And so they're doing their regular work, whatever that may be around the bureau, and then they would go and do that work additionally as needed.
That is really helpful for me to know, and I appreciate it. And it also takes maybe, I am interested in that particular day just because I happen to be doing, you know, I'm doing ride-alongs and sit-alongs around the public safety area. But it takes off some of the concern because this council did adopt a budget note as part of the budget process that directs the use of overtime to prioritize things like threats to life and safety and to deprioritize the use of overtime on protests. So I am content knowing that that will be a prioritization shift that has already been directed by council. And by the way, sort of tangential to that, I did want to take the opportunity to, I did do a ride along with FIT, and I appreciate many of those officers are also part of ECST, and appreciate their hosting me on that ride along and appreciate the conversations that we had. I've directed it to them specifically, but I just wanted to say that publicly as well as of course the BOEC telecommunicators I mentioned earlier. I will stop here and kind of go back around the circle and come back around when the time gets to me. So I'll go back to Councilor Smith.
Thank you. That was legacy. Are there any things that that are critical to your work that you were not able to get either one enough or to be able to be funded in this last budget cycle that you would like to see going forward?
Certainly funding is what drives us, as we know.
And or policies too. Yeah.
Policies out of the
policies budget. And resources and appropriations.
Mm-hmm. I think that to continue to do the work we're doing, it's.
I see Director Causey is.
Is he jumping up and down?
He's breathing really hard. He went
me right now.
He looked like he wanted to come up to the table.
He wants to answer this one. So.
Like a DCA kind of question. So thank you so much.
There you go.
I know I'm in the right place if I see his face getting red.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Interim DCA Causey, overseeing the public safety service area. And we've had some conversations already. And as I have sat in this seat for a little bit over a month now, what I'm recognizing are some similarities and differences between PPB and BOEC, because that's where I have the most experience. And one thing that I'm trying to figure out is how we might be able to have a full grasp on the overtime requirements mm-hmm. for PPB and shift away from the over-reliance on using vacancy savings to fund overtime. So when we talk about future budget, I want to be able to say we have funding for X number of FTE, and we have funding for X amount of overtime, and here's exactly what that overtime is dedicated for. Particularly when we think about, backfill overtime for precincts. We also look at any special operations, there's overtime tied to that, and recognizing the need for staffing at the same time, and not conflating the two, so that we're relying on vacancy savings to pay for overtime usage.
Okay. So I hear what you're saying. You're just looking from a global standpoint and you haven't dug really deep about what you're going to do for next fiscal year. Because I'm already on next fiscal year
in terms
of my thinking.
We're trying to get the lay of the land so that we can really know what we need for next fiscal year by the time we start the budget process.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Smith. We'll go next to Councilor Novick, and then I have an update for the traffic stop thing after that.
Thank you. Continuing randomly jumping around, I have one question that sort of relates to whether a prejudice I have is accurate. I saw that 11 of the deadly traffic crashes involved motorcycles, 4 involved bicycles. My working assumption is that there's a lot more bicyclists than there are motorcyclists in the city. So that would tend, if that's true, it tend to suggest that motorcycles are dangerous things. People should think twice about driving them, but I could be totally off base. I just wanted to know if any of you, you know, haven't, am I just speaking based on prejudice, or is it true that driving a motorcycle is unusually dangerous?
I don't have any statistics off the top of my head to tell you about percentages of vehicle usage in the city. I think as a parent, I would like to emphasize that motorcycles are in fact dangerous, particularly in the hands of folks that maybe are not as well trained or familiar with how to operate them, or just really excited to go way too fast on our city streets. And so I don't know, we see a lot of, you know, we see a lot of crashes, unfortunately, and they really run the gamut of types of crashes. So I don't have any further comment on how much or which way. So
I wanted to ask a question about an area of spectacular success over the past few years, which is the reduction in motor vehicle thefts. And I was wondering, what do you attribute that to? Did you break up a number of sort of organized motor vehicle theft rings? Were all the Kias and Hyundai stolen, so there were none of them left to steal? What do you think some of the factors are in that spectacular reduction?
Yeah, I can speak a little bit to that. It goes back to about 3 years ago. We were provided a grant, $800,000 grant by the DOJ, and partnered with the OHSU Cancer Knight Institute, and to start really looking at like evidence-based indicators of what a stolen vehicle, some of the factors surrounding that, and then we push that information out to our officers so they would have that information available. And then also I want to highlight just the partnerships with our other law enforcement agencies. And we were able to develop a model and provide specific information to officers that would increase the likelihood of identifying a stolen vehicle. And so that program is gaining national notoriety, and other cities are looking at how they can implement what we have incorporated here.
So it's not just, it's not just breaking up rings, it's simply identifying individual stolen vehicles and getting better at that?
Correct. There have been some rings that we have identified throughout the course of that program. And that's definitely one component of it, but it's also the increase in correctly and accurately identifying, like, this is a stolen vehicle, mm-hmm. and then getting it stopped.
I have to say, I've heard some satisfied stolen vehicle customers in the past few months saying that they were very pleased with the response they got and got their vehicle back. Another question I have is about homicide solve rates, which I think that the most recent data you have is about 56%. Now, that seems incredibly low. I know it's part of a national trend. I'm curious what you have to say about why that trend has been so bad, you know, across the board in the past like 30 years. But also, and this might be an impossible question to answer, are there a lot of cases where you think you have a pretty good idea what happened, you just don't have a provable case? Or are most of the unsolved just, we have absolutely no idea who killed this person?
Fairly rare, I'll say. We generally, obviously the majority of the time, have a suspect in custody. What happens through the justice system is other things, but and then there are a percentage of cases that we have a suspect identified, but we don't have enough to viably make that arrest or take that to trial with a reasonable expectation of a successful conviction in that case. And so pending additional statements, witnesses, evidence coming to light, they won't push forward a prosecution in the case of a homicide that is iffy, right? They're going to put through cases that they know that they have a case that they can get through the system beyond reasonable doubt. And so, and or information exists that indicates this might be the person, but it is not able to be substantiated. Simply someone saying that's who did it isn't enough to make a case and launch through the justice system. So myriad of factors. The lesser, though, are the complete whodunits of it's a complete mystery. Generally speaking, homicides involve people upset with each other who know each other. And there's a reason, an identifiable reason, not a random act of violence, generally speaking. There's always exceptions to that, but more often than not, we know, you know, where it's happening, who's involved in that, and then it's just about putting that case together effectively. Yeah.
Now,
say our solve rates this year are, I don't have it off the top of my head, I wish I did, are quite high this year, 2025. But what you're also seeing and what plays into that in some way, shape, or form is rates of homicide. So our homicide rate is lower this year. And so that allows our investigators, who are limited in the number of hours a day that they are able to work, can devote more time to the cases that they have. We've also had a number of cases where operations is right there or able to shortly thereafter make an arrest. And that, so our, and we would consider that there's a lot of work that still needs to go into the case, but you know, that's a win for us. That's a clearance for us. So.
One explanation I've seen for the nationwide decline is that a larger percentage of the homicides are committed with guns, and it's hard, sometimes harder to solve gun-related homicides because maybe people aren't like carrying a bloody knife around. Is the solve rate higher for non-gun than gun homicides, or is it about the same? Do we know?
I don't know the breakdown of, you know, solve rates as it relates to mechanism. I don't know that.
Last question I have, and I actually talked to Commander Hughes about this last week, but how many people are in the narcotics unit? Their job generally is to chase down drug dealers and seize drugs, as opposed to, I mean, they're like sort of high level drug dealers, as opposed to, like, you know, they're trying to sort of break up the supply of drugs rather than like sort of livability, you know, open air drug market arrests.
Narcotics and organized crime unit is primarily trying to take on organization level or that higher level. So not street level. That's not to say that they don't participate in those missions. They do. Certainly we focus them on those missions as appropriate, but or occasionally or as needed or as identified. But generally speaking, they're working higher level investigative cases where they're trying to get more to supply and before interrupt it before it gets onto the street.
So. And how many people are in that unit?
Golly, I would have to look to know off the top of my head. I'd be making it up at this point.
Is it closer to 20 or 10 or?
No, I think 12.
It's closer to 10.
11 or 12, okay. Yeah.
I mean, what do you mean? I think there's a lot of people who would argue that trying to interrupt the supply of drugs, even though the high-level detours might be really bad people, is trying to drain the Pacific with a teaspoon. And interdictions don't really reduce the amount of drugs on the street enough to affect things like the overdose rate. Is there evidence to show that that is or is not true that you're aware of?
I think it's difficult to prove a negative, but I think when we take pounds of my personal belief without a statistic to prove it is that when we take pounds and pounds and hundreds or thousands of doses of fentanyl or meth out of the supply chain, that is a good thing for the city of Portland to not have those drugs ultimately end up on the street. That's sort of the core of their work. And I do believe that that has a positive impact. It's really difficult to quantify if that drug had made it to the street. What is the potential impact of that? How many ODs, which I don't know how to substantiate that. I would want to start to point things like our really high overdose rate and our really low numbers in our narcotics and organized crime unit. And when those two things were existing and now we've bolstered that unit and we're seeing ODs coming down. Are those directly related? I don't know. Statistically over time, we could certainly work to analyze that. But to me, that is anecdotal evidence that we are moving in the direction we should.
I mean, that's something I think would be really interesting to see comparisons in other jurisdictions. Are there jurisdictions that have seized a ton of drugs and they still have some of the highest overdose rates in the country? Are there that don't seize any at all and their overdose rates are lower? And that seems like it is subject to some possible statistical analysis. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Just to get back to the stops data question, and I think we found it's the most clear on the 2021 one. So if Christopher, if you could put that up on screen. And the reason it's the most clear in 2021 is this is the PPB open data presentation from 2021 in which it's on a single table. In the other cases LUC will show you 2024 in a second. It's on two different tables and it's up to the reader to sort of compare. But this is the traffic stops for 2021 on the right side is the percentage by racial category, perceived race. For example, for Black and African American drivers, it's 472 stops, which is 12.7% of the stops. And then this additional column, the middle one here of injury collision benchmark, is provided for comparison. I think that's a fair assessment, right? And the percentage that is being given is based on the injury collision benchmark, of which 15.1% of the people involved in injury collisions were Black or African American. And so that is the basis for the comparison that leads to this sentence in the bottom left. Traffic officers did not display any differential treatment based on the perceived race of the stopped driver. In fact, 12.7% is less than 15.1%. If one were to use a different benchmark, that could lead to different analysis. There is 6 to 7% of the population of the city that is Black or African American. I don't know the number for 2021. That's why I'm giving a range here. And so 12.7%, if compared to that, would show a very large disparity. And so I think that's where the controversial, and I say this from the perspective of having previously supported PSEP, where many people have brought this up in the meetings, that this particular benchmark, benchmarking process has been, I think, a pretty big topic when there's the quarterly and annual reports presented to PSEP for stops data specifically. For non-traffic, it's violent crime victimization statistics, which is another a different benchmark than population. Does that make sense? So if one is saying 12.7% is less than 15.1%, one could say there is not over representation in stops data of Black drivers. If on the other hand, one was saying 12.7% is more than double 6%, that is going to lead the viewer to say there is a very high overrepresentation of Black drivers in traffic stops. And so the choice of benchmark matters for how a reader understands it. So I'll give it back to you if you have any questions there, Councilor Murillo, on this particular one. And while you're doing that, if you could pull up the 2024 data, because we are talking about the 2024 report.
I don't have any questions. I think you broke it down well. I think it's just important for this to be, I think you laid it out well. It doesn't have to be that complicated, to be honest.
Yeah, the way I wrote my question leading into this is, when will the PPB change the benchmarking standards? I think if every year you've heard it, the late Dan Handelman would bring this up every year in the PSEP meeting, that it is, in particular, the violent crime victimization rate to justify non-traffic. It seems kind of, I don't know that population, I think PPB has this analysis in the long form of the stops data report that explains why population has a limitation too. And I wanna acknowledge that there are reasons why that is not used. But I can tell you from doing community engagement that it often comes across as obfuscation when it is that particular benchmark is used. And so I would love to ask if that is something that Strategic Services could work with PSEP, but certainly I think there's some interest in council to develop something that, you know, because certainly people don't always drive at the same, there's geographic deployment of where PPB is doing traffic stops. That's going to matter for the demographics of the people that might be driving in that neighborhood. There's reasons why it's, you know, I can see the argument for why population might be not ideal, but my question is if that's something that Strategic Services would be willing to do an open process and get changed. Because for 4 years now, I've seen this debate at PSEP and also in some of the precinct meetings around this report.
I don't want to make you respond to it right now, but I want to give you the chance if you want to.
Well, yeah, I'll take it. Certainly take it back, and we'll discuss it again. My benchmarking and statistical analysis is, you know, not generally in my wheelhouse, but certainly yes.
Fair enough. It might be helpful to have someone from SSD for the full council. I don't know what our seven colleagues who aren't here would ask. I'm going to pause this here because we do have four people who are signed up for public testimony. So I will ask if we can go to that and then come back. We do have another 35 minutes of this committee meeting to discuss. So we have four testifiers. There should be some time for that. Thank you to our presenters. And I'll ask, because there are four and we have four seats up here, Rebecca, if you'd be so kind as to just call all four together.
Corinne Frechette, Odelia Zuckerman, Philip Chachka, and Jason Renault.
And not seeing Corinne, I'm hoping she's online. Well, feel free to go ahead, Odelia, and then maybe by the end, if she is available, we can get Corinne back on. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Hi, my name is Odelia Zuckerman, and I'm co-chair of the PSEP, which was just being discussed prior. I first wanna say thank you for acknowledging the in-custody death of Damon Lamar Johnson. PSEP will be hosting a community listening session on this next Wednesday, the 23rd, at the Portland Building and on Zoom from 6 to 9 p.m. I also want to thank AC McMillan for including detailed information about the stop state in the presentation we saw today. I do want to acknowledge that none of that information appears in the report itself, which informs the comments I'm about to share on. If the purpose of the annual report is to inform the public about progress and challenges at PPB, it should include more information about the ongoing challenge of ensuring police stops are free from any form of racial profiling. As the counselors may know, PPB releases a separate report entirely about stops data, including the nature of stops and a racial disparity analysis using the injury collision benchmark and the crime victimization benchmark. Per PPB's 2024 stops report, a benchmark's value depends on the extent to which it can help explain alternative reasons why stop rates might be different among different groups of people. Quote, the reason PPB says it uses injury collision and crime victimization as a benchmark essentially is because drivers of different races are more likely to experience traffic collisions. So therefore, PPB stops drivers of different races at a higher rate because they're, according to PPB, worse and more dangerous drivers. PSEP has also considered this data practice to be confusing at best and problematic at worst. It's difficult to grasp why we wouldn't instead use readily available census data. PSEP has long questioned this practice, and last year we recommended to PPB that they utilize an additional analysis called Veil of Darkness to improve confidence in the results. PPB rejected this recommendation. Though we do appreciate that PPB has committed to referencing the state's Veil of Darkness analysis moving forward in their reports, we believe more could have been done. Again, I want to emphasize that PSEP has taken issue with the injury collision benchmark for many years and still fails to understand why the stops are not compared to baseline census data. Even with the current benchmarking analysis, PPB stops showed concerning racial disparities for 2024. Although PPB says there are no disparities, the numbers tell a different story. 46% of the focused intervention team or FITS stops were Black people and 21% were Latino. Out of all PPB's non-traffic stops, 22% of people stopped were Black. This even exceeds the injury collision benchmark that PPB uses, where Black people made up just 13.6% of collisions versus 22% of stops. I strongly encourage this committee to hear a separate presentation about stop state in this forum. PSEP also welcomes discussion with all of your offices about our longstanding concerns and its impacts. Thank you.
Thank you, Odelia. Philip?
Okay. My name is Philip Chachka. I'm with Portland Cop Watch. We continue to be just disappointed in the precinct and council presentations of these reports. As a reminder, the US DOJ agreement paragraph 150 requires the Bureau to make the annual reports that educate the public about its efforts to in community policing in regards to use of force, about PPB's policies, laws, and governing pedestrian stops, stops and detentions, and bias-free policing, and include a civilian's responsibility and freedoms in such encounters. These items should appear in the report, which may encourage the Bureau to properly address them in public meetings. I did notice that the presentation and the summary did include some of that, but it's not actually in the report itself. Given the concerns over the last 25 years where police data show Black Portlanders being stopped at 2 to 4 times the rate of the representation in the population, it's shocking that in this report, there's no analysis or data from the Strategic Services Division about the use of force, stops, arrest data, or bias-free policing. The SSD handles stop data reports, and instead of providing a summary or analysis of the data, the annual report linked in their website and left it to the readers to do their own research about PPB's state of affairs. As a result, the 2024 annual report appears to be out of compliance with the settlement agreement. In the 2023 report, some information was given about the focus intervention team stops, but doesn't address race or ethnicity. In the 2024 report, it includes only the stops related to anti-street racing special missions. In his cover letter for the 2023 annual report, the chief listed transparency and accountability as secondary goals. And this year, he doesn't mention those goals. And in various places that accountability is mentioned in the report, it barely touches on holding officers accountable for violating policy. Once again, data about internal affairs do not show how many violations were found, nor how many forms of discipline were imposed. The annual report makes no mention of new oversight system that was negotiated in 2024. We'll give the Bureau a pass in omitting this information designed to be an independent of the police. In the report itself, there's no mention of deadly force incidents. They mention it in the presentation, which is not in the report. We need that in the report. Also, use of force is barely mentioned. Once again, there's little information about the use of force. Like last year, the behavioral health unit talks about, I'll skip that. One last thing, homeless and houseless people are part of the community, and the report itself makes no mention of poverty or homeless or houseless people.
Thank you. Thank you, Phil. We'll go to Jason next.
I'm Jason Renaud. I'm with the Mental Health Alliance today. The Mental Health Alliance is amicus to US DOJ versus City of Portland. Thanks for being here. I'd like to start by saying thank you to Councillor Canal for expressing condolences for the family of Damon Lamar Johnson. That's a first. We have advocated our organization, and then later, after much persuasion and argumentation, the PSEP joined us in asking prior administrations to express their condolences. And it had been a fight all the way along and never occurred. It's a first, thank you. In response to the annual report, just the response to the first point of the first item about trust and how trust gets broken so quickly and so expensive and takes so much time to repair. I want you to think about for a moment the thought of a family member or a neighbor of a person in a mental health crisis using 911 tonight. Are they going to do it? Are they going to make the call? Are they going to delay? When that trust is broken, our whole emergency services system collapses and doesn't function for that community that where the trust has been broken. That repair can be done, but it relies on good partners. And I'd say we've had two or three important things that have happened just in this one case. One is the proof of the use of body-worn cameras. Suddenly we have a new tool brought by a lot of labor on the part of the police department and a part of this council to bring body-worn cameras to existence. Thank you so much to Commissioner Chief Day and his predecessors for making that happen. But now we have documentation of what occurred. Sometimes it goes one way, sometimes it goes the other. The second is that I think in this case, we have an instant recognition by everyone that we need to send the right response. And police are not always the right response. And the city has struggled for a long time to create the right response to send as an alternative to police. That's almost there, not quite there, much more work to do. But we now see the value of Portland Street Response and similar alternative responses. More effort, more integration to do here and to avoid these tragedies in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Has Corinne Frechette arrived by any chance? Or is she online?
She's not.
Okay. Thank you, I assume.
That concludes testimony.
Thank you. All right, we're now in committee deliberation. I'll reopen the queue if there's anyone who'd like to say anything or ask anything. Okay, Councillor Smith, is that a legacy hand?
It's a legacy.
Okay. So I'll make the motion, I guess, to move to refer the Portland Police Bureau annual report to the full council for consideration. And may I have a second, please? Thank you, Councillor Smith, seconded. Is there any discussion on this motion? Okay, I'll note here, I'm gonna try to just telegraph. I have a few questions that we didn't get time for, but that don't affect my consideration of the report as a whole. So I'll probably email those to follow up. The one that I would like the presenters at PPB to potentially be ready for is a little more information on clearance rates. I think that might be helpful for colleagues to understand the working definition and for the public, certainly the working definition of clearance rates and where that's at. For me, that is one of the tables I'd like to see as a category by category breakdown. I think that's a metric that we should be trying to support increasing over time. And by we, I mean not only PPB, I think part of that is our responsibility as council and the remainder of the executive branch as well. And I'll also commend the inclusion of the statistic on 1,425 firearms seized, the body-worn camera information that's been included, as well as the information around recruitment. Not only because it's good to have the information, but because the information about recruitment is good. And then the only other thing that I'd like to highlight, I think it was brought up in testimony, is I think it would be helpful to have a little bit more information. You know, the death in custody last year was it was in the presentation, but not in the report. And to get a little bit more information as to PPB's perspective, it's a PPB report, on the deaths of Matthew Greer, Nicholas Thorne, Richard Sean Perez, and Matthew Holland, who were the four people that died in some sort of incident involving police last year. Just for transparency's sake, I think that would be helpful. So I'll leave it there. Any other comments before we go to a vote? Okay. So this is a motion to refer. A yes vote sends it to council. Rebecca, will you please call the roll?
Mario.
I'll make my comments brief because I know it's before a vote. I really appreciated the testimony today from folks who came to talk about the report. And I don't think that I can in good conscience vote yes to move this to full council given the death of Damon Lamar Johnson this past week. I think it's pretty unacceptable that this police report does not have a comprehensive, understandable analysis of racial disparities. I'm also concerned about the missing pieces of the use of force. And this just continues to be an issue in our city, and it has been for years. And so I just don't think that this report is sufficiently addressing the community concerns and needs of Black Portlanders, Latino Portlanders, Portlanders who are people of color who are targeted by police in different ways. And I think we have a lot of work to do, so I vote no.
Novick.
Aye.
Zimmerman. Smith.
Aye.
Canal.
Thank you. I share many of the concerns around the comprehensiveness of the report. I view these, as I've mentioned to Administrator Jordan in the context of his reports, as an iterative process, and this is our first one. I also note this is a motion to refer for consideration by council without, and I think I'm hoping that the conversation at the full council allows for us to evaluate it in its fullness. That's not the right words, but I think you know where I'm going. So with that, I will vote aye. The motion carries.
Sorry, three ayes, one nay, one absent.
So, and the Portland Police Bureau annual report will move to the full council. That concludes the second of two items. I did want to flag our next meeting. So this meeting is the June 10th meeting that was rescheduled to the middle of the month. We do have our regularly scheduled meeting next week. We are hoping to discuss an informational presentation on the settlement agreement that was referenced today between the Department of Justice and the city. A discussion of the hiring process and philosophy for high-level public safety service area positions, including a review of the recent fire chief hiring process. And I'll just take the opportunity to note that I did talk about a few ride-alongs I have gone on. I haven't gotten to fire yet, but I'm looking forward to doing that between now and our next meeting next week. So with that, the meeting of the Community and Public Safety Committee is adjourned at 4:11 p.m. Thank you.